the very basis of a spiritual process, or the very fundamentals of a spiritual longing, is to transcend the limitations of the physical. The most intimate part of physical creation for an individual being is his own body. The limitations of the body and the possibilities of the body. To explore the possibilities and to go beyond its limitations. The physical body, which is designed and structured to function by itself without much of your participation, you know? This body is designed in such a way that it functions by itself. You don't have to make the heart beat, you don't have to make the liver do all its complex chemistry, you don't have to breathe. Everything that is needed for the physical process to happen, for your physical existence to manifest itself in a proper way, is happening by itself. So the physical body is a very self-contained, quite a complete instrument as instruments go. It's quite a complete instrument. And if you keep it well, you may go through your whole life without ever having a spiritual longing. It's possible because it's so complete by itself in its own nature. If you're fascinated by gadgets, there is no better gadget. Every little thing you explore in this body is quite incredible. It takes a certain amount of intelligence and awareness for a person to see the limitations of this fantastic gadget that it is. Gadgetry is fine, sophistication of mechanism is fine, but still it doesn't take you anywhere. Just brings out of earth and gets you back to earth. Isn't it enough? If you look at it from the perspective of the body, it's quite enough. But a dimension beyond the physical somehow got trapped in this physical, somehow was infused into this physical, without which there is no life. Life is one thing, but the source of life is another thing. In every creature, in every plant, in every seed, in every animal, in every bird and worm, the source of life is functioning. It is just that in a human being, it is functioning with little more presence. A dog also has the same source of life within him, a worm also has the same source of life within him, but it's not so manifest in them, it doesn't have a strong presence there. Here, it has a stronger presence. Because of that, all the trouble started. Because of that, we had to devise this impossible yogas, you know. We have to do all kinds of things because the source of life has a larger presence in the human being compared to any other creature on this planet. Because he's taken on a little high-profile presence. Because of that, suddenly all the simple things or even wonderful things that the physical offers somehow becomes irrelevant. Because the fragrance of that which is the source of creation is such. Once you get a whiff of that, the fragrance of the physical doesn't appeal. So, because of this one aspect, a human being is a constant turmoil. A human being is a constant struggle between the physical and that which is beyond the physical. This is the only thing which is setting him apart. This is the only thing which is making him, though he is also physical, in contradiction with the physical, though he also has the compulsiveness of the physical, he has the consciousness of not being physical. So, all of yoga, every kind of spirituality that you can find, I refer to it as yoga, because it is all different types of yoga, either done systematically or blindly, but still it is yoga. Any method that you employ to enhance the presence of the non-physical within you, any method you employ to heighten the presence of that which is the source of creation within you is yoga. How you do it, either by using the body or your intelligence or your emotion or using the fundamental life energy, it doesn't matter how you do it. Whatever you do, you only do with these four wings of who you are, for these four dimensions of who you are. So everything that you do to enhance the dimensions beyond the physical is referred to as yoga. So all these yogas became necessary because of this fundamental conflict, or a seeming conflict. I wouldn't really call it a conflict. It seems like a conflict between the instinct of self-preservation and the longing to become boundless. These two forces are not against each other, but when you look at it from a physical perspective, when your whole perception is limited to the physical, they seem to be in conflict, but they are not really in conflict. One belongs to the physical, another belongs to a dimension beyond the physical. If one has the necessary awareness to separate the two, then there is no conflict. But if one does not have this awareness, if he is identified with the physical, then there seems to be a conflict between these two fundamental forces which make a human being what he is right now. If you go by the ways of the body, it knows only self-preservation and procreation. It's incapable of anything else. These two are the only two aspects of the body. If you go by the dimension beyond that, the longing to become boundless, unfortunately most of the time trying to find physical expression to this longing to become boundless leads a man into all kinds of activity, insatiable activity. Even if somebody's body is aching, you can't make them sit. Do you see? You went to Himalayas? Your body is aching enough, it says. But no, you must go to the top of the mountain and come, because you want to be little more than who you are all the time. You always want to be little more than who you are. This longing is a never-ending longing. This longing is not seeking for little more. It is seeking for an ultimate expansion. So these two aspects become a conflict because of a strong identification with the physical. Once you get deeply identified with the physical, then these two fundamental forces, one which helps you to root yourself well on this planet, another which is supposed to take you beyond. Unfortunately, instead of working in collaboration, they become a conflict. All the struggles of humanity in terms of should I be spiritual or materialistic is just coming from this ignorance.
Sadhguru, how come like a boy with 6 years old, he can remember his last life, he can tell who he is, who's his parent, and sometimes he can tell who killed him, where and how. And after a time, he can forget everything.
Yes, how come he can remember? He should not remember. Nature has given you this cocoon of life so that you do not remember. It has given you a protective wall so that you do not remember. Because if you remember, you will become a far bigger mess than you are right now. See, these few years of living here, 10, 20, 30, 60 years of living here, people are just struggling with the memories of their life, isn't it? Yes, people have great struggles with these few years of memories. Suppose a few lifetimes of memory opened up, you know what a turmoil and struggle it would cause within you? Just being here, you're still struggling with relationships. You're still not able to forget what happened yesterday, what may happen tomorrow. All these struggles are going on. Suppose you realized, let's say you remembered your past lives and you realized your dear son happens to be your neighbor's pet dog. Suppose, I'm just saying. These days dogs are having a better life than us. Yes? You know what a havoc it would cause in your life and in your neighbor's life and in the dog's life. It wouldn't be good for anybody, isn't it? Unless you're in such a state of understanding and dispassion that even if you come to know this was your wife or your mother or your father or your dearest friend, you can still continue without even looking at them, then it's okay to know. But if you're somebody who has emotions for everything that you think that belongs to you, see, this is the problem. People's emotions are coming only towards those things which they call as theirs. Suppose, let's say, you have never met your father, or you have not seen your mother since you were born, or you had not seen your twin brother or a sister in your whole life. Today, I showed you, see, this is your mother. You have never seen her, you have nothing to do with her. But now, because somebody told you, this is your mother, the moment you say, oh, she's my mother, suddenly emotions burst out. From where? You have not built a relationship with this person, you have nothing to do with this person, just because somebody says, this is yours. When somebody says, this is your mother, somebody is saying, this person belongs to you, isn't it? So your emotions flare up only to those things which you consider as mine. So, if you have this problem that everything has to be yours, only then it'll happen, then I would say, get little more greedy, make everything yours. Why be stingy on your greediness? Take it all the way. My children, I have tremendous feeling. Make everybody yours. What's the problem? Somebody there to stop you? Is somebody there to stop you? If that's your way, take it all the way. Or nobody is yours, that is also fine. It's a harder way, but that is also fine. Nobody is mine, is fine. Everybody is mine, is fine. This is mine, that is not mine, this is a problem. So, if you remember past lives and you are in this state that this is mine and this is not mine, then you're going to get into lots of trouble, too much trouble, more than you can handle. So a six-year-old boy just by chance remembered something. It's just sometimes the systems in the nature fail, you know. Some data input mistake. It happens. Such a complex structure, sometimes, you know, it happens. Little bit of mistake, the necessary protection was not created in a particular child. Even if they do, usually before they grow up, they tend to forget. Lot of children below 4 years of age clearly remember their past, but by the time they become 4 years of age, it all dies out. After 4 years of age, they get involved in this life, whatever is around them. Till their 4 years of age, it is possible in their minds the past could be just going on. I don't know if you're aware of this in India, for a variety of reasons they said this. They say, till the child is 4 years of age, he belongs to God. Only after that, he belongs to you. Because they're saying, because he's running with so many memories, he doesn't belong to anybody at that time. After that, once his memory goes off, he starts relating to everything around him in a deeper way. That's when he begins to belong to you. At least he gives you an illusion that he belongs to you. Yes, they'll break it after some time. They do, isn't it? One way or the other, they do. So, it could happen, it's happened many times, but generally such people forget after some time that that capability or that kind of aberration, I would say, happens only at a certain phase of childhood. After that it dies by itself.
Sadhguru, at the beginning today you said that the human is one where the source of creation has a greater presence. Now why does it have to be so? Is it just nature's ploy, existence ploy, a play where we are all just some kind of software programs designed for self-annihilation with some support systems? Why some people have the longing, some people don't? And why some people with longing find the right place or the right avenues to get their longings fulfilled? What is the secret behind all this?
For the first part of the question, why are you asking me? I didn't create this damn place. I'm only trying to create a solution. I didn't create the problem. So, is this all apply for people, the spiritual people, to run their business? Do they have some kind of a deal with the Creator that He keeps people in such a turmoil that these people can run their show? Possible. So, why this whole thing is made like this? Is it some kind of a conspiracy between the spiritual gurus and the Creator? No. It's all conspiracy from the other side. We are trying to beat the conspiracy. We don't have a deal with the conspirator. But we have made friends with him. Now that we have made friends with him, we can get him to open the door. Or we have found the keys ourselves. Even without his permission, we started opening the door these days. Now why in one person there is a longing, in another there isn't? There is no such thing. In everybody there is a longing. In everybody there is a longing to be little more than what he is right now, isn't it? In everybody there is such a longing, that is a spiritual longing. It's just that most people do not recognize it as such till a certain amount of pain or suffering or old age or the constant threat of death enters their life. Till then, they will not recognize that longing for what it is. They will go on painting all kinds of pictures. Using that longing, they are painting a million different kinds of pictures on a daily basis. They think it's about money. They want to fool themselves that it's thinking that it's about a man or a woman. They know very well it's not so. But they like to keep the game going and keep the game going and keep the game going forever. They think it's all about a new house. They think it's about a new job. They think it's about a promotion. They think it's about wealth. Not that they really think so. They just like to play this game. Everybody knows that none of these things will fulfill them. They know it very well, isn't it? But they still continue to play the game. So why the game is so difficult is, the situation is like this. Shankaran Pillai and his wife were sleeping in the night. The wife thought she heard some noises downstairs, she thought there must be a burglar. And she said, "Hey, are you awake?" Shankaran Pillai said, "No." That's why you can't wake them up. You understand? They're really asleep. It's very easy to wake them. Gently you can either kiss them awake if they are gentle people, or you can put ice cold water, a bucket of ice cold water, and wake them. But the problem is they're awake and they pretend to be asleep. Now you have to coax them not to pretend. You know it's difficult. You know it's difficult. That's why it seems so difficult. Not otherwise. If people were really asleep, it would be very easy to awaken them. They're awake, but they're pretending to be asleep. Now, if you see, a man who is pretending to be asleep, if you roll him over, he'll sleep this side. You make him sit up, he'll sleep sitting. You make him stand up, he'll sleep standing. When he is determined not to wake up, then it's takes lots of work. That's the foolish work we're doing in the name of spirituality. To wake people up who are already awake, but who like to pretend that they're asleep. Otherwise, why this going on and on? One satsang is enough, isn't it? Just one satsang is enough. Why another one, another one, another one? Because one satsang, you roll them over like this, then they sleep this side. Next satsang, okay, that didn't work, you roll them like this, they'll sleep that in that position. In every new position, they will sleep. So you don't let them sit in any position, you keep them moving, 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 moving to a point of frustration where they'll get up, okay, this damn man won't let me sleep anyway. What the hell? Let me come awake. This is the way fools will wake up. But the intelligent should wake up the moment they know they're awake, they must open their eyes and see. Those who are eager for life, those who are looking forward to the day, the moment they're awake, they will get up and come out. Those who are not looking forward to the day. If sun comes up, they want to deny it by the blanket, isn't it? So that's why the spiritual process are designed like this. You like it or you don't like it, 5 o'clock in the morning, get up, cold water, and sit down and do everything that you have to do. No, I don't like it, I don't like it. It doesn't matter you don't like it, just do it. You're asleep, it doesn't matter. You still walk around and do everything. If you do this for some time, then you will realize, what's the point pretending? Anyway, they'll make me do all these things. Then it'll not be worth pretending. You're creating a whole range of illusions for yourself. Life should disillusion you somewhere, it will. The sooner it does, it's good. When life doesn't, a guru tries to hasten the process of disillusioning you. Do not understand disillusion as a negative process. Disillusioning means destroying your illusions, isn't it? If you get disillusioned, is it a positive thing or a negative thing? That's a whole problem with life, isn't it? If your dreams break and you come down to reality, that's when you struggle most and suffer most, isn't it so? Yes? Isn't it so? If everything that was an illusion broke and it landed you in reality, you must be joyful. But just the reverse is happening. Because you're awake and asleep, that's the problem. If you were asleep, there was no problem. If you're fully awake, it's absolutely wonderful. You're awake, but you pretend to be asleep. This is a serious problem.
Sadhguru, I just wanted to ask about alternative therapies and the effects.
I'm sorry?
About alternative therapies like acupuncture, shiatsu, Reiki, and I wanted to cover aura healing just in case I ever got interested in it, but how they affect you as a practitioner. Because what I read in Mystic Musings, that if you give Reiki to somebody, you're actually taking on their karmic patterns, which was a bit concerning.
Why is it such a concern?
I think I got enough karma of my own. I don't really need anyone.
You don't want to take any of their stuff?
Not particularly, no.
Oh.
It's about handling my own stuff.
So, alternative therapies. I think we did not really talk about therapies like acupuncture or pressure or any of those things. We were talking about healing systems, energy healers. It's only in that context we said this, not in terms of acupressure or acupuncture or massage or anything of this. People who are trying to do meddle with the energy, because you do not know all the nuts and bolts of how this system is made. Just meddling with one thing without knowing the other can cause various consequences, not just about taking on karma. It can cause various consequences which are not necessary, which is very immature to do. But alternative systems of treatment, either in the form of Ayurveda or homeopathy or acupressure or whatever, they are alternative methods of treatment. They are different. healing systems are different. We were saying that only with reference to healing systems, not of alternative systems of treatment.
Sorry, can I just ask then, in terms of Reiki, which is about working with people's energy, if you are a Reiki practitioner, how do you protect yourself then from taking on karmic?
By not doing it. Because these are all things that have come out of dropouts from Buddhist ministries. You meddling with another person's life process without knowing the whole of it is irresponsible. It is like you saw, you know, these days you can see videos of major surgeries happening. So you saw a video like this, you observed everything very carefully. So tomorrow somebody has a problem, you take a shaving razor and decide to do a surgery upon him. I'm telling you, some people may survive this. People have survived such things, isn't it? Many times in battle zones, in nature, when accidents happen, people have performed absolutely crude surgeries upon somebody and they have survived. But that doesn't mean that's the way to do surgery, isn't it? That's not the way to do surgery, isn't it so? It's just that some people might have survived such surgeries. In extraordinary conditions, it was done. So, any kind of meddling with other people's energies is very juvenile. It's coming out of a certain immaturity. And a certain egoistic state of wanting to play God, which is not necessary.
Can you say something about the significance of participating in the Nadaradhanas each day, either singing or playing the bowls, drumming, or either just simply being there and meditating?
One important reason why we started this process, which we call as Nadaradhana, is because the energy of Dhyanalinga can become like a solid wall. It can become so intense that for those who penetrate through it, it will be wonderful. Others will sit in the temple but will sit outside the energy. It can become like that because it is so intense, it's almost physical. I don't know, now that many of you are having a dip in the Tirthakund and then going into the temple, I'm sure some of you must have felt when you enter the temple, it's almost like a physical thing, it hits you. If you're sensitive to it, it's almost physical. Because the field of energy that gathers around the linga is so intense, it can be like a strong wall. If you penetrate that, you'll be wonderful. Otherwise, it would be not available for a lot of people simply because of its intensity. If it was of a weaker intensity, then a lot more people could enter. So twice a day, we are sort of cracking this wall by using certain sounds, sometimes melodious sounds, sometimes bad sounds, discordant sometimes, sometimes very melodious. We are Isha, you know, we are like this. We have people who have no music background of any sorts doing music, that's the miracle of Isha. It's very positive on one level, could be very frustrating on another level. But it's good, it at least disillusions you. and it works. So the sounds that I'm making, melody is only relevant to the people. The melody of the music that they produce is only socially relevant for the people who are sitting there. But as far as the purpose of making the sounds is fulfilled, even if they are discordant, because the idea is to disturb something there, which is manifesting itself into something very intense, almost like a solidified presence, so that it becomes little more accessible to all people who enter. Twice a day, we just little shaking it up. You could just do it with a few shouts and some, you can take kitchen utensils, make noises and do that too, if you do it intensely enough. But we want to use that as an offering also, so that it becomes an offering. Because in a state of offering, a human being is most receptive. Why always? In the Indian way of life, if you go to the temple, you must offer something. Not because God wants to eat your banana or coconut. If you don't have bananas or coconuts or whatever, you must at least offer a leaf. The idea is that you go with an intention of offering. You go as an offering. When you go as an offering, you're most receptive to what is available there. So the times of Nadharadhana, because they are a time of an offering, definitely it's the most receptive time for people. For those of you who are unable to experience Dhyanalinga for what it is, if you're struggling with it, the best time for you to be there is definitely Nadharadhana time. One thing is because we are loosening the structure, surrounding structure in a certain way. Another is it's a time of offering, and that is the most receptive state to be in.